So our second speaker today is Julia Landweber, and Julie is Associate Professor of History at Montclair State University. She received her PhD in History from Rutgers University, and her most recent article, This Marvelous Bean, was published in French Historical Studies in 2015. It examines the question of how the French adopted Arab Ottoman coffee and reimagined it as their own national drink over the course of the 18th century. She is currently writing a book on the history of coffee in France to be called Embracing the Queen of Beans, How Coffee Was Adopted in France, 1660 to 1789. And her title today is Establishing Coffee Production in the 18th Century, East and West Indies.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And thank you, everyone, for coming to the first session of the day, which is always a bit challenging, particularly those of us coming from, well, I don't know, maybe from the East Coast, it's not so hard. Elizabeth was talking about the colonial machine and social eye. It's a theme that runs through some of these things. All right, so Europeans have been importing exotic foods dating back to the era of the Roman Empire and probably long before. During the Middle Ages, spices from the East were instrumental in shaping elite medieval cuisine. However, for a long time, the demand for these goods had little or no effect on production. This would change in the 17th and 18th centuries with the quest for and transfer of tropical plants to European soil and to its far-flung colonies. The French state supported the formation of sugar, cacao, coffee, indigo, and cotton plantations in its West and East Indian colonies, while encouraging, as we have heard, the identification and cultivation of many other useful plants in these same places. State-sponsored science, in the form of a network of botanists and botanical gardens founded in both metropole and colonies, aided these projects. Establishing commercial production of agricultural commodities, in most cases foreign to the colonies, was often fraught with challenges. In today's paper, I'm going to examine the messiness of this process with a case history of how coffee came to the 18th century East and West French Indies. From rocky beginnings involving the smuggling of fragile seeds and rare cuttings in the 1710s and 20s to the so-called coffee revolution that exploded across the French Caribbean between 1765 and 1785, the history of coffee demonstrates how knowledge of non-European plants could be turned dramatically into profitable enterprises in the 18th century. James McClellan and François Rigaud, in their study, The Colonial Machine, point particularly to coffee's role in the French colonies as, in their words, a powerful example of the economic value of applied botany. However, the colonial machine was, I've been having a crash course in the colonial machine recently, and what I've discovered is that it was a very Byzantine apparatus whose parts did not always work together as a harmonious whole. The Marine Council was one part of it. It largely oversaw the colonies, and it supported French planters' interest in coffee. Then you have scientific institutions, notably the Académie Royale des Sciences and the Jardin du Roi, which worked together, both of them in Paris, and they made many efforts to assist coffee cultivation projects. But there's also a third part of the machine that I'm very interested in, the Compagnie des Indes Orientales. It was also a state-sponsored organization. It worked closely with the scientific institutions and with the Marine Council, but it used royal edicts as a tool to fight many of these same colonists' attempts to develop coffee commercially. And colonists had to thread a path between these conflicting positions within the colonial machine, which ultimately governed their actions and their lands and their profit potential. I thought it might be useful to see at a snapshot glance where I'm talking about. So if you can see the red dots around, some of them very tiny in the South Indian Ocean, for example. The 1710s were a decade percolating with coffee-growing projects. Over the previous 30 years, coffee's reputation had advanced from first impressions in France as a risky drug to becoming an increasingly fashionable beverage desired by all who could afford it. With money pouring out to pay foreign importers, coffee had begun costing the French far too much. And so, as this map shows, our locations in France, in Arabia, in the Indian Ocean, and in South America, men of very different backgrounds independently hit upon the same idea that France should enter into the business of producing coffee. For some, this would mean acclimating the plant to France itself. For others, it involved locating new sources of coffee indigenous to existing French colonies. A third set was sufficiently confident in Arabian coffee's durability that they begged, borrowed, or even stole seeds from any source available and then transported and transplanted those seeds everywhere they could find takers. The term acclimate, meaning to adapt exotic plants to new climates, appeared first in French in the 1780s, and it seems to have been a French concept. But practice preceded vocabulary by many decades. In August 1713, botanist Antoine de Jussieu received a gift of seeds from a Dutch colleague in Amsterdam. By November, he had sprouted the seeds at the Jardin du Roi, where he was a professor. He would then publish a report on this, actually several reports, and he wrote in his first report, "These trees have become very common in Holland." This is a report to the Royal Academy of Sciences that you see here on the left. One hopes, he continued, that soon they will also spread in France and thrive even better, because France's climate is more temperate, and the seeds of these trees grow very quickly, end quote. The following year, his young plants were joined by one or two mature specimens that soon flowered and fruited, and in 1716, the Royal Academy of Science elected Dr. Apothecary Michel Isambert to transport three of de Jussieu's plants to Martinique, with the goal of testing whether this now Frenchified coffee might flourish in the West Indies. At the same time that de Jussieu was tinkering with acclimating coffee plants in Paris, others were slowly discovering that on France's Indian Ocean colony, the Ile de Bourbon, shown here, or modern Réunion, a wild variety of coffee was already growing abundantly. The first mention came in a 1710 report by Antoine de Forges-Boucher, who had been stationed on the island as a quartermaster and secretary to the governor. Although he addressed his memoir to the directors of the Compagnie des Indes, which controlled Bourbon, evidently no one noticed. The Compagnie's secretary general, Louis Boivin d'Ardancourt, visited Bourbon on a completely unrelated fact-finding mission a year later in 1711, and he was startled when one of the several slaves accompanying him and a planter on a tour of the countryside pulled some grains out of his pocket, which Ardancourt immediately identified as wild coffee seeds. Even more surprised was the planter leading the tour, who had not recognized the trees growing all around. Quote, "We retraced our steps to find wild coffee trees, 10 to 12 feet tall, full of fruit and mature pods falling to the ground," reported Ardancourt. "I collected as much as possible, made two small bales, and brought it back to France to know its quality." Yet it wasn't until 1718, after another sample of Bourbon coffee was presented to the company directors in Paris, and de Jussieu had approved the idea of a new variety of coffee that might rival mocha, that the company decided to invest in its cultivation. Meanwhile, also in 1711 to 1713, a delegation of French merchants from Saint-Malo, sailing under the aegis of the company, made the second of two historic voyages to Yemen, or Arabia Felix, as they called it, for the coffee trade. An invitation to visit the ruling imam had three unexpected results. And their first voyage, they only were on the coast in the city of Mocha, where there's a huge coffee market. But the imam who ruled Yemen lived 8 days' walk in the interior in the city of Moab. So they had to. This was the first time they went to the interior of the country. So there were three results. First of all, the Saint-Malo merchants were able to negotiate a treaty for Louis XIV involving a promised shipment of mocha coffee plants for the Ile de Bourbon. Secondly, because they went inland, they became the first Europeans to actually see Yemeni coffee plantations. And thirdly, they learned the Yemenis' methods for cultivating coffee. All three things held tremendous potential for the future of French coffee cultivation. As the merchants stopped in Bourbon for a lengthy pause on their way home to France, they could have shared their news and knowledge with the islanders whose land their parent company controlled. So it would appear that all the necessary parts were coming together to make Bourbon the leader in French coffee production. But, of course, history is rarely so tidy. And this is a manuscript map. I know it's a bit hard to read, it's dark, but it's very interesting. Manuscript map of Bourbon. Okay, so as I was saying, history's not as tidy as we'd like it to be. And the colony of Bourbon struggled mightily at what should have been an easy project. Despite having an indigenous source of coffee at hand, and then receiving bonus coffee arabica plants direct from Yemen in 1715, and having the backing of the Compagnie des Indes, Antoine de Forges-Boucher and the governors he worked for before himself becoming governor in 1723 had to force uninterested colonists to grow coffee. This he did with a combination of debt forgiveness, arm twisting, and price manipulations. He offered them advance payments against future harvests. He raised the price that he would pay for coffee, and because the company didn't fully trust the Bourbon variety, he paid extra for mocha beans. Finally, these things not working, he threatened to sequester any planter's harvest unless that person could prove that he also had at least 200 mocha coffee trees capable of fruiting. It wasn't until 1725 that Desforges Boucher could report confidently to the company directors that, quote, coffee is making incredible progress on this island despite all the hitches. And so we can see on this map there is coffee growing. This is Desforges's own plantation, and I believe those are also coffee trees that he was cultivating. He says, it has become absolutely naturalized here. I believe the quickest way to make this island wealthy and valuable to the state would be to shut off trade with Yemen. Our coffee is of equally fine quality, and the shipment of 1726 will be of good size, and it will doubtless grow every year thereafter. Conversely, halfway around the world, so now we're zooming around to the Caribbean, French colonists in the greater Caribbean region were very keen to grow coffee. Tragically, Jussieu's representative, Michel Isambert, if you remember him, he contracted yellow fever and died within a week of landing at Martinique in 1716, in July of that year. His plants were forwarded to a botanical station in Guadeloupe, but they died in transit too. 3 years later, the governors of Martinique and French Guiana separately decided to try again. They each wrote to the Marine Council, requesting botanists from Paris and plants from, respectively, Yemen and Dutch Suriname. Their requests failed. The company had no intention of losing what was by now a monopoly on all coffee imports to France, both from Yemen and from Bourbon, and the Dutch and Suriname had become fiercely protectionist about coffee. After much delay in 1720, the Marine Council decided to ignore the company and make a second attempt to send some of De Jussieu's plants to Martinique, but that's another story. In Guiana, meanwhile, Governor de Villiers' lieutenant, François de Lamotte Aigrand, had already taken matters into his own hands. In 1718 or 1719, he contacted a rogue planter named Morgue, who about 8 years earlier had fled Guiana for Suriname over Amistide. So you can see they're right next door to each other. He offered amnesty if the man would only return with coffee seeds. D'Orvilliers told the Marine Council, quote, Morgue has planted the seeds and is tending them carefully. We want a close-up here. And is tending them carefully chez Monsieur de Lamotte Aigrand, for whom he now works as a steward. So there's Lamotte Aigrand's plantation inside Cayenne, which is the island at the north part of the colony of Guyane. Within a few years, Cayenne had become a propagation point for the distribution of coffee seeds to France's Caribbean colonies. Lamotte Aigrand, with the assistance of Intendant Paul Lefebvre d'Albon, set up an agricultural station at Fort Saint-Michel, shown up there, from which they sent forth seeds as fast as planters would accept them. Guiana got its botanist a few years later, but cultivating coffee had by then shed any pretense of being a science experiment and was well on the path to commercialization. By 1722, they had produced enough seed to share with fellow colonists both locally and in Martinique and Guadeloupe. In 1724, when the first real harvest was ready, d'Albon sent a sample to Maurepas, Secretary of State for the Navy, writing modestly, I take this liberty in the opinion that you might be pleased to judge for yourself the quality of Cayenne's coffee. During the 1720s, a total of 8 island colonies plus Guiana developed commercial coffee cultures in the greater Caribbean. So I've identified them all here. Plus, of course, in the Indian Ocean, sort of shown off there, Bourbon coffee seemed to be prospering. Weirdly, these successes occurred amidst a period of institutional chaos for French coffee commerce. The problem centered on the role of mercantilism and the issue of profits, where coffee, already clearly a commodity with tremendous lucrative potential, was concerned. The question, which no one seems to have asked until it was too late, was why and for whom was France supporting so many coffee cultivation projects in such far-flung corners of the world? Was it wise to grow coffee everywhere and let it enter freely into France? Or was the mercantilist impulse to tightly control development and importation more fiscally prudent? The answer depended upon one's perspective. Was the intent to line the royal coffers and revive the fortunes of the Compagnie des Indes? Or was it to assist planters in the colonies and enrich sellers in the metropole? Or, if money was not the issue, was the goal to deploy new botanical and scientific expertise at the frontiers of both agricultural and dietetic knowledge for the benefit of the French people. Now, we might scoff at the last proposition as too idealistic, but there were those who, like de Jussieu, fervently believed that coffee was both a medicinal marvel and worth planting just to see where it would grow. But money was, of course, the issue, and by the early 1720s, the French state found itself tied in a Gordian knot over what had become conjoined questions of how to regulate coffee importation and production. A generation earlier, when coffee had been grown commercially only in the Yemen and reached France only via the Mediterranean, the crown had named Marseille the sole point of entry for coffee. In 1699, the Compagnie des Indes Orientales acquired the right to be the exclusive carrier of coffee to France when it was granted a national monopoly on the direct trade with Yemen. The Compagnie, now run by a consortium of Saint-Malo merchants out of the Atlantic port of Lorient, had no desire to reroute their ships to Marseille. Yet the Marseille Chamber of Commerce insisted on its prerogative to levy a 20% entry duty on all coffee entering France. This was the first problem. The Compagnie attempted to further consolidate its control over coffee when it pushed the colony of Bourbon, which it also governed, into coffee production starting in 1715. Marseille merchants began complaining that either the wild coffee coming out of Bourbon was fake, in which case the Compagnie was perpetrating a fraud by selling it in France as coffee, or if it was real, then the Compagnie was violating Marseille's privilege by importing it through Lorient. This was the second problem. When the Caribbean colonies, over which the Compagnie had no jurisdiction, began producing coffee as well, the Compagnie must have felt besieged on all sides, and this became an unexpected third problem. To extend McClellan and Rigord's metaphor, the wheels in the colonial machine were getting gummed up. At first, the Compagnie talked the Royal Council into siding with it against Marseille. In 1723, a royal arrêt asserted the Compagnie's exclusive privilege to sell coffee in France. But as it became evident that Guyana and Martinique were going to rival Bourbon as coffee producers, the Compagnie began lashing out with a series of edicts forbidding any ships other than theirs to carry coffee to French ports. And of course, as an East India Company, they weren't involved in the American shipping trade. This threatened, quote, grave consequences for the Colonie des Îles, where coffee was being heavily developed, end quote. This is a quote from the governor there. And that governor of the Windward Islands, Champigny de Norrois, worried in 1729 that, to another quote, it would be difficult to convince planters to abandon coffee, having already invested so much in it. And he was right. In Guadeloupe, Guadeloupe recorded its first commercial harvest later that year in 1729, and then Martinique in 1730. If French bottoms could not legally carry their coffee, they nonetheless would, and did, smuggle it to France anyway, with the help of cooperative ships' captains. In 1730, the Compagnie tried again, arguing that its right to import coffee from one island, one French island, Bourbon, gave it the right to trade in coffee produced by any and all French islands. But this was too broad a claim. In 1732, the Royal Council broke the Compagnie's privilege at last, quote-unquote, provoking joy amongst the planters of the Caribbean and Guyana. The colonial machine had restored itself by taking power away from one area of operation and granting it to another. Thank you very much.